Rafia is a very short, very smart Israeli who Wilson always believed was a highly placed Mossad agent. He was used to dealing with all sorts of people, but he says he has never encountered anyone like Wilson. To begin with, Rafia was not accustomed to having congressmen or senators come to him. They always summoned him, and he would appear at their offices, armed with charts, maps, slides, military attachés, and ministers. Wilson's arrival an hour after his call startled Rafia. He was wearing cowboy boots and a Stetson, and from the perspective of the 5'6" Rafia, the congressman looked like a giant. But what surprised the Israeli most was Wilson's impressive command of military history and his keen understanding of weapons and tactics. Rafia quickly realized that Wilson had developed a powerful identification with the Israeli cause, and when the congressman said he wanted to go to Israel immediately, Rafia was quick to accommodate. 3 days later, Wilson was driving in a jeep in the Sinai with fellow Representative Ed Koch. The Israeli army was taking them to the front of the Yom Kippur War, sweeping them past still-burning Soviet tanks. He was ecstatic to be in the presence of these heroic warriors. It was the beginning of a 10-year love affair with everything to do with Israel. "I bought the whole thing. The beleaguered democracy surrounded by Soviet-armed barbarians, survivors of Nazi concentration camps, David versus Goliath." Wilson would go on to become one of Israel's most important congressional champions, a non-Jew with no Jewish constituents. Years later, Tzvi Rafia would muse on this curiosity. "I visited his district once, and I was very impressed with the oil pumps and the big fat cows lying in the shade. Every time I describe a rich country, I describe this scene in Lufkin, the cows in the shade of the oil pumps. But believe me, there are no Jews in Lufkin." There was perhaps another ingredient beyond his mother's exhortations that went into Wilson's embrace of Israel. His future co-conspirator in Afghanistan, the CIA's Gustav Rakatos, suggests that Charlie had a kind of James Bond syndrome. "As I saw it, the tie that bound us together was chasing pussy and killing communists." Avrakatos's blunt language tends to turn people off, but the CIA man has a raw genius for understanding what makes Wilson tick, and his point is that, along with a worthy underdog to champion, two other ingredients were necessary to fully mobilize Charlie Wilson: a communist bully to put down, and a beautiful woman by his side. In Israel, it began with a raven-haired captain in the Israeli Defense Forces. She was the congressman's official guide to the war zone, and Wilson's infatuation began on that first trip into the desert to see the burning Russian tanks. Ed Koch still remembers his horror when the beautiful captain's commanding officer, offended by her growing fascination with the goy in the cowboy hat, ordered her not to return the next day. Koch saw Wilson as a potentially invaluable asset to Israel, a non-Jew on the Foreign Affairs Committee who was more passionate about Israel than any of its Jewish members. "He was unique," Koch recalls, "an oil man who was pro-Israel." Koch quickly took the commander aside. "Are you crazy?" he asked. "The woman is 21. Let her take care of herself." Captain Lilitov remained at her post. Wilson admits that he was infatuated with the beautiful officer whose husband was off fighting in Egypt. But he says the relationship remained purely platonic, mainly because a few days later, in the lobby of his hotel, he was introduced to Israel's leading movie star, Gila Almagor. "I remember thinking this is a hell of a place. You get Russian tanks burning on the desert, beautiful captains, and movie stars." To Wilson, Israel was filled with nothing but glorious underdogs who didn't want or need Americans to fight their wars for them. All they were asking was for U.S. military supplies and economic assistance to counter the Arabs who wanted nothing less than to use their Soviet arsenals to annihilate Israel. By the time he got back to Washington, Wilson had become, in his own words, an Israeli commando in the U.S. Congress. And quite to his surprise and delight, a remarkable thing happened. The Jews of Houston and Dallas discovered the congressman from Lufkin. Without any solicitation, contributions began rolling in from all over the country. The AIPAC, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, people loved me because here I was, a cowboy from Texas, hysterical about their cause. remembers Wilson. The congressman soon found himself giving the major United Jewish Appeal speech of the year in Washington and addressing young Jewish leadership conferences all over the country. This friendship with Israel grew so intimate that years later, when Wilson determined that the CIA wasn't willing to provide Afghan rebels with an effective Mule portable anti-aircraft gun, he secretly asked the Israelis to design one. They came through, as they always did. And when Wilson was engulfed in a drug scandal that jeopardized his 1984 re-election campaign, Ed Koch mobilized supporters in New York and Jewish backers of Israel from all across the country to pony up $100,000 in campaign contributions and save the day. It was also the Jews in Congress who would rally to put Wilson on the all-powerful Appropriations Committee, where he could help make sure the annual $3 billion a year in aid continued to flow. Getting the appropriations assignment as a junior congressman was an amazing political maneuver, because his own Texas delegation opposed it. They backed a Texan with more seniority. The only other congressman to ever defy his own delegation and seek an appropriations seat was Lyndon Johnson, but LBJ failed. It was Wilson's Jewish friends who made it possible. From his new position on appropriations, Wilson began to learn how Israel and other special interests use their power. He discovered that the authorizing committees, like Foreign Affairs, were little more than debating societies. He now served on a committee that doled out the nation's money, 50 men appropriating $500 billion a year. He watched and saw how one man, if he's on the right subcommittee and knows how to play the system, can move the entire nation to fund a program or cause of his choice. By the late 1970s, Wilson was starting to feel his power. He had become part of a small tribe of Democrats alarmed by what they perceived to be a policy of appeasement by their own party. The Israelis had been whispering in Wilson's ear ever since Jimmy Carter came into office that the United States was getting soft, looking the other way as the communists advanced everywhere unchecked. But Wilson's concerns were independent of the Israelis. He genuinely believed that the Soviets were out to conquer the world. And he was unnerved when he saw the pictures of President Carter embracing Soviet Premier Leonid Brezhnev and kissing him on both cheeks at the arms control talks. To him, it was an ominous replay of that critical moment before World War II, when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, pursuing his policy of appeasement, emerged from negotiations with Hitler to announce peace in our time. Timing is everything. And it was just at this moment, with these dark thoughts racing in Wilson's head, that Congressman Jack Murphy appeared in Charlie's office to make an appeal. Murphy was the kind of Democrat Wilson could relate to, a West Point graduate and decorated Korean War veteran. They were drinking friends, but Murphy had not come to socialize. The two considered themselves part of a lonely group of Democrats holding the line against the Soviets. And Murphy was preaching to the converted when he savaged the president for appeasing the communists. Now, he said, Carter was about to betray America's oldest anti-communist ally in Central America. It was unconscionable to stand by and let it happen, and Wilson was the only man in Congress with the power and the balls to stop it. Anastasio Tacho Somoza was a particularly unattractive dictator, with thick black-rimmed glasses, weighty jowls, and a disturbing leer when he smiled. But over a bottle of scotch in Wilson's private office, Murphy told a heartwarming story about how he had gotten to know Tacho as a schoolboy at LaSalle Military Academy in New York, and later as his roommate at West Point. Somoza had created a little USA in Nicaragua, Murphy explained. The U.S. Army had trained his entire Army Officer Corps, and his son was a Harvard man. More important, he reminded Wilson, the dictator had turned his country over to the CIA in 1954, when it had needed help to overthrow the Guatemalan government, and Tacho had played a critical role in the Bay of Pigs as well. His only crime, Murphy said, was that he always supported the United States, and now Jimmy Carter wanted to destroy him because the hand-wringers at the State Department claimed he was violating human rights. At that very moment, Murphy announced, to dramatize his point, the Cuban and Soviet-armed Sandinista guerrillas were attacking the cities of Nicaragua. If Wilson didn't use his leverage on the Appropriations Committee to try to protect Tacho, Carter would get away with cutting off all Somoza's military and economic aid at a moment when it might just do him in. The zeal with which Wilson took up the challenge caught everyone, particularly the Carter White House and the State Department, utterly by surprise. By the time Charlie intervened, saving Somoza seemed to be a lost cause. The Appropriations Subcommittee had already sent the bill that cut Somoza's funding to the House floor. The unwritten rules of the Appropriations Committee dictate that members don't challenge the overall subcommittee bills once they have been reported out. But in a stunning political maneuver, Wilson took the Nicaraguan aid issue to the floor, where he threatened to scuttle the president's entire foreign aid bill if Somoza's money was not restored. He told his colleagues that Somoza had done an enormous amount of dirty work for the U.S., that he was virtually an arm of U.S. intelligence. It was hardly a popular cause. The columnist Jack Anderson had just labeled Somoza the greediest dictator in the world, to which Wilson responded, "No one is perfect, no one is pure." Miraculously, Wilson won the first round. To the disgust of liberals, the media, and the administration, Somoza's entire $3.1 million aid package was restored. A jubilant Representative Murphy insisted that Wilson accompany him to Managua over the July 4th recess to meet Tacho. One of Wilson's more endearing features is an ability to understand how ridiculous he often looks to those witnessing his antics. Many years later, he would recall with humor the lavish dinner party Somoza threw for him.
"Everyone was looking at me with enormous respect," Wilson recalled, "as if I were Simón Bolívar. Tacho gave this great toast in which he credited me with being the only thing preserving freedom in the hemisphere. The entire oligarchy of Managua was there applauding. I will admit it was kind of heady,